Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 17th, 2002, and today's session is entitled, What Was God Doing in Australia Before the Europeans Came? It is presented by Norman Hubbell, and it is tape number HAN 2002-13. Let's listen in.
I'm going to be doing this session on what was God doing in Australia before the Europeans came. Now, I'm doing it partly with my assistant over here, Mark, and Mark is Skokomish Indian, and I want to recognize that the Skokomish people were here long before we were, and that they are the custodians of a large part of this part of Washington. Whenever I begin anything, in any public lecture in Australia, no matter where I am, I find out first who the traditional owners and custodians of the land are. And all big many major functions at universities and so on are now begun by recognizing the traditional owners of a place. My understanding is the Chelan Indians came up this area, but the wider group is the Skokomish of this area. So I acknowledge them and recognize them. I'll come back to that question later on as to why I think it's important now to do that. And what I want to do to start with is to give you a bit of a picture of the history of Australia, what Australia's history was, but not just from the point of view of the Europeans, but the point of view of those who are the indigenous peoples of the country, people with whom I've been working over the past years in one way or another. And Mark is here as a good indigenous member of this community to keep me honest, because every once in a while you fall into the immigrant way of thinking and you simply do not recognize the sensitivities of the people who were here before we came as Europeans. So I want to go through the history a little bit so you get a picture of Australia's history and how we related to the indigenous people, what we did and said to them. And then I want to look at what the indigenous people's basic belief system was, how they related, and their special relationship to the land. I then want to look at how we worked with a group of indigenous people called the Rainbow Spirit Elders to develop an indigenous theology. And last but not least, to give you some slides that relate to the Rainbow Spirit theology and how you would read Genesis 1 and the pictures that would be there if you could look at Genesis 1 from the perspective of this particular traditional understanding of creation. Now, we're not going to be using the Bible right away, so you don't have to worry about grabbing the Bible. Normally you do when you're in my class. Just as a bit more background, I have been working for quite a long time with indigenous peoples in the process of what we call reconciliation. And reconciliation is a major movement now in Australia in the last 10 years, but especially the last 5 years. And so this little book of mine, Reconciliation, Searching for Australia's Soul, we had a session on this on Australia last week, and the book sold out and nothing flat, so there you go. But we do have a few other, I'll talk about them later. So I want to give you, first of all, this bit of a sweep through Australia's history in its relationship to the indigenous people, and then from that move into indigenous culture, then into indigenous theology, and finally into some of the ways in which we might be working towards reconciliation. So it's a fairly broad sweep, but you'll find it reasonably interesting, I hope. Now, how many of you have been to Australia? There you go, right there. So sometimes it's because even Mark's been there. You know, that's amazing, absolutely amazing, fantastic. And the way you have to start this, I think, is to turn the lights on. There we go. The way you have to start is if you do have a timeline to write at the beginning. That one's not good enough. If you want a timeline at the beginning, what you need to recognise is that before any of the dates that you remember or know about, you've got 60,000 years of indigenous peoples in the land. 60,000 years. Used to be said to be 20, then we discovered it was more, and now we know it's at least 60,000 years. Now, I have no idea where they came from. There are theories that they came via India, and there are people in South India who look very much like. The Tamils in South India look very much like Indigenous Australians. In fact, my wife and I adopted a Tamil girl in South India when we were there. And some people still mistake her for an Indigenous person, but she's not, of course. Not Indigenous Australian, she's Indigenous Indian. By the way, this, I might know, if you go to India, how many Indigenous people are there in India? Tribal people. 30 million?
Oh, more.
50 million?
Yeah, please.
50 million. There's three times as many, maybe 60. Three times as many tribal people, Indigenous people in India as there are people in Australia. We don't even think about it. There are Indians, traditional Indians, but there are also Dalits, which are outside the caste system, and below the caste system, and below the untouchables, quote, are the tribals. That's a whole different story. And their culture is also fascinating, but usually, yes.
Sorry, no, I think I was including the Dalits.
All right, if you include the Dalits, see, the Dalits are, if you include the Dalits, have got to be something like, well, much more, they've cut 200 million.
Yeah, I was going to say 200 million.
Yeah, it's 200 million Dalits. The Dalits are the crushed people, those people who are below the caste system. You've got four castes, and below the caste are the so-called untouchables, which are now called Dalits. And then in addition to the untouchables, or the Dalits, are something like 30 million tribal people, Indigenous people, which we know very little about, and I never get into the media at all. Now, in Australia, 660,000 years, there is now recognised to be something like 250 languages, right? 250 languages, and 500 peoples, 500 nations. They weren't big, but they're all discrete, separate people. They're related to each other in various ways. Now, a lot of those were basically destroyed, and we thought, many of them we thought were totally destroyed, but we've discovered that's not true. In the last 10 years, when we've begun to recognize and acknowledge it, and being an Aboriginal person is no longer such a shameful thing to be, well, there's a lot more there than we ever thought. All over the place. And Tasmania, for example, in the last century, they had what was called the Black War. And the farmers and various other people made a big black line with guns, called the Black Line. And they marched through the entire state. Like, take California, no, not quite California, but say Dakota. Put a line right across the people, right across Dakota, and march down and attempt to exterminate everybody. And they thought they had. But they haven't. We're discovering them all over the place now.
And this was what year?
Oh, about 1870. Horrible story. And there's a famous book, movie called The Last Tasmanian. Well, there isn't the last Tasmanian at all. Now, these languages, most of these languages, some of these languages still survive in the central part of Australia. Others have died out, and others I'll talk a bit more about later on. If you go to the 18th century, then we have all these people who came with ships to Australia, and they did what? Well, they explored all around Australia, and you have, quote, them, the so-called discovery of Australia. Of course, it's not a discovery at all, is it? We call them the discoverers. They didn't discover a thing. They'd been there for 60,000 years. Huh? But it's important that the language we've got in all of our textbooks is the language of the people who came, not the language of the people who were there, and the orientation of the people who were there. And so when we talk about 1788 and the famous Captain Cook, who came with the first lot of convicts, right? It's then that they said that Australia comes, and now instead of saying it was the first settlement, we now speak of it, if you're from an Aboriginal perspective, as the first invasion. And it's really, you can smile, but in fact it's true. It's an invasion. An invasion of territory which was inhabited and with people that have very carefully organized social systems, legal systems, everything. But nobody bothered to ask about it at all. Now, when they first came, Captain Cook arrives and he sets up a flag. What was it? Union Jack, of course. Sets up the flag and he declares the land to be, this is a very important term for us, terra nullius. It's an extremely important term. Terra nullius means land that is not occupied, legally occupied. Came to mean land that was nobody was there, but in fact it's land that's not legally occupied. And you can hear it in all sorts of places. Just by chance, once when I was sitting in, I was sitting in Bethlehem looking out about 5-6 years ago. We were having a conference, and there was one hill of all the hills around Bethlehem, there was one hill that had trees on it. Suddenly all these trucks appeared and bulldozers. The Israelis had come over into Palestine territory to bulldoze it and take it. Why? Because it was terra nullius, not occupied. Therefore it was free. Palestinians weren't developing it, whatever it might be. So terra nullius is a term you'll find all over the place, and for us it's crucial. Because that policy determined the history of Australia until 1965. It was only in 1965 that we declared the Aboriginal people citizens of Australia. It's a storm, isn't it? 1965 we declared them citizens and they had the right to vote. They went to war and fought for us in the Second World War and often were called American Negroes, but nevertheless, technically. And so some of them managed to get to be called, have Australian citizenship as a special favour, but they were only special favours, they weren't involved. So in 1788, Captain Cook comes and the beginning of the process, then around 1800, and a few years later, a very important character comes called MacArthur. And MacArthur's very famous because he brings sheep. And the whole idea that Australia could be more than a convict settlement happens when he brings some sheep over. And the sheep became the source of Australia's basic wealth and future. Not anymore so much, but it certainly did for 100 years. Another piece of the history, I'm not going to give you a lot, but enough to give you a feel. 1836 was when the first settlement happened in my state of South Australia. In South Australia, I am pleased to say, was a little more civilized than the rest. In South Australia, we had a governor called Governor Hindmarsh, followed by a Governor Gawler, who came to set up what was called a Christian economy, a society that was based on Christian principles in which everybody was free to worship as they chose and live as they chose. Now, it was an ideal which lasted about 10 years till we got a racist governor, a racist son of a Frenchman for a governor, and he just said, no more of this. And in 1839, a little piece of history that's important because we're digging this up now in order to recognise the kind of things that the Aboriginal people did. In 1839, Governor Hindmarsh said, I want to set up a school for Aboriginal children. Unheard of. Ridiculous. And he sent to Germany and got German missionary linguists, Teitelmann, Sherman, and Closer. And they came and they set up a school for Aboriginal children in 1839, which lasted till for 6-7 years. And they taught Aboriginal children, and they taught them, can't believe it, in the original Aboriginal language. In Kaurna language. 150 years ahead of their time. And that language was preserved and put in a dictionary by Teitelmann, and we've now published it and released it, and we're using it in schools to teach in Adelaide. A few things happened, but we need to recognise those things. And those missionaries used, for the great leaders of the time, Millulebuker and various other leading Aboriginal people, preserve the language. One of the things, therefore, we're concerned about, if you're going to preserve and recognise the peoples, you need to preserve their language, if at all possible. And that's crucial. Now, this was unusual, and it lasted a short time. What's more important is what was happening in the rest of the country. The South Australia was irregular, not like the rest of the conflicts and the people who were really aggressive. There was opposition in England to what was happening, but in Australia, the whole policy up until 1900, when we became a Commonwealth, up until that time, the policy was one of total dispossession. Dispossession of absolutely everything. Culture, all the rest of it. Why? They said, well, these people are simply, quote, nomads, point one, savages, point two, and an inferior race, point three. Therefore, either there's no point in worrying about it because they wander everywhere, which is not true. That was what they said. They're savages because they don't have any organized society, which they never did understand, and they're inferior race. One has to recognize that racism was a fundamental concept that organized the way we established our commonwealth. Country is a commonwealth nation. Racism was primary. And we assumed that this group of people were inferior intellectually, technologically, every way. You ever use this expression, somebody's thick? You're thick. It's a common expression. It's actually a racist term. Originally, when racism developed, and a lot of you may know more about racism than I do, but as racism developed and tried to become a science, and they could analyse different races and what was different, it was an assumption that the Caucasians had a bigger brain. And the blacks, like in Africa or Australia, had little brains. Then when they came to Australia and found out the Australian Aborigines had bigger heads than the others, therefore they must have had smaller brains and thicker skulls. So to be thick is to have a skull which is like that of inferior race. That's where it came from. Now it's important that you understand that racism was so powerful, the assumption was that this race would die out because the assumption is that they would die out. So it didn't matter. Second assumption is that they were clearly inferior. They were savages, they were pagans, and, quote, they didn't have any religion. Amazing statement. Didn't have any religion. And so all these stereotypes were simply accepted right across the board, and it didn't matter what really happened to them. So there were large-scale dispossessions of land, and even where there were missions, the missions didn't ask my question, what was God doing there? The assumption is really these were godless people. godless people, so we are bringing God to them. God isn't there before we get there. I'm going to pause a minute so that you can reflect. Are there things you want to ask me before I go to the next stage? Seems that I know there are a lot of strong parallels.
Yeah, I can parallel almost the year 1788 from Cook on is similar to...
Yeah. Now, what happened here in this country is you guys made treaties with the indigenous people here, then broke the law. I read a book which has all the treaties and everyone was broken, or denounced or renounced. Are there comments that people... Yes.
I think the whole thing about... I've done a lot of study of comparative religions or history of religions, and often it seems like traditions, they have a really hard time accepting, and not all traditions, but another tradition, or so when they encounter each other, so that question I think is pretty important in the world today, to have some way of acknowledging other people's religious traditions or religious experiences.
See, they didn't have church buildings, and they couldn't identify a single god like we have, so they could not get into the fact that their religion was there.
Organized religion.
It wasn't organized in the way the Western religion was. But when we actually begin to look at it in a little while, it's a highly sophisticated thing.
Yes. I'm from Alaska, and I've been there for over 50 years, and again, the patterns, are the same. And I think, too, that with the being called pagan and everything, the good missionaries, et cetera, who came, or others who came who thought they had God, didn't recognize the forms of worship.
That's right.
And the forms of relationship that they had with God, and didn't see that because it wasn't, the Englishman's way or the German's way or whatever.
Mm. No, they simply didn't even try, really. Now, it's striking that the German Lutherans, despite that wonderful little bit of history there, 1839, German Lutherans came in 1838, the years that followed, and they brought their vines with them. And now they are the center of the wine industry. And that wonderful valley, which is full of the wine industry, was totally dispossessed, and they don't give a rap about it. Yet they've got a mission station, but it was right in the center of Australia. We've got to send money to the missions to save the Aboriginal people. But they're only doing it at a mission station right in the center. Where it's away from, and, you don't really have it. It's sort of like, you always have your missions at a distance. We sent them to New Guinea or to the centre of Australia, but you didn't do anything about the people you just about destroyed right in your own backyard. That happened time and time again. It's a very sad story in mission history. Now, the question I've asked, I won't answer it till later. The question I asked was stirred for me when I was at the seminary in St. Louis many years ago. I think it was one young preacher got up. I was young too, but still. Some young preacher got up. And you all remember the Lutheran Hour, huh? Mm-hmm. The big slogan, bringing Christ to the nations. And he got up and he says, bringing Christ to the nations. What a lot of falsity. Christ was there before we ever went. So that question of what God was doing, what was Christ doing, has been around, but it hasn't had a lot of play. Now I want to tell you a bit more of history, and this is the tough bit. Most of us did not know that in 1920 on, from 1920 to about 1970, as late as 1970, the Australian government had a policy which had two sides to it. One is called the White Australia Policy, which you've probably heard. And the White Australia Policy means we're not going to allow anybody who's not pure, white, and beautiful to come in. And some Americans were allowed in, but otherwise, a few Europeans were allowed in. You know, but we had a very, very rigid policy. But more important, in fact, than that policy was the policy of assimilation. Now, assimilation is a policy in which you attempt to somehow or another breed out or remove color. And we'll all end up being beautiful Aussies like me. And the assimilation policy was the basis on which all kinds of things happened that basically removed Aboriginal people from certain places and allowed the massacres to take place. And some of the massacres happened as late as the 1830s and 1930s and 40s. But more important than that was something that I want to tell you about, which is called the Stolen Generation. Now, the Stolen Generation is a story that hurts. I am so ashamed of my own country when I have to tell this story. From 1920 to 1970, it was the policy that if there was a half-caste, we call them half-breed, whatever term you use, negative term, somebody who was half-caste, and they are living in some ranch or some part of the country with their families, the police would come and take that child or children. Sometimes they weren't half-caste, they were basically fully Aboriginal. They'd take them from that place and remove them to a place 1,000 miles away. Totally cut off, so they would have no possibility of ever knowing who their parents were. And then they would... Yeah,
if you want, I can relate to that in the Native American perspective, because I lived in that era.
Did you? See, if an Aboriginal person like you was sitting in the room with me today, every chance would be that he or she was one of the Stolen Generation.
I would have taken away.
Thank you. The Stolen Generation are those people taken away from their families by the government and put either in a mission or in a so-called orphanage. And that, thousands of people, thousands of children, and some of the great leaders of Australia now, Aboriginal leaders, are Stolen Generation children. And of course they said they did it for two reasons. One is, of course, behind the scenes is to actually try and eliminate the black in the society.
Take care of the Indian problem is what they
said. Yes, quote, take care of the Indian problem by dissipating and assimilating and removal and breeding them out. The second thing is not only to take care of the Indian problem, but hopefully then not have any more of these kind of people. And the rest would just die out.
What they did was try to dissipate the race.
That's right. And mix them up.
Yeah.
And so you have these so-called orphanages all over Australia, or missions, and sometimes the missions rescued the kids and they had a slightly better life. But in the orphanage, you would either be adopted out, sometimes happened, or you would be made a domestic servant of somebody and work for somebody. And this was happening until 1970. Now, the striking thing is, three blocks from where I live was one of those orphanages, a place called Colebrook Home. And all sorts of very well-known people now were there. And they were told, everybody was told, your parents are dead or your parents abandoned you. Because these horrible Aboriginal people didn't care about their kids.
Or move them further away where the parents weren't able to know where they were.
That's right. Exactly. So here we have an example of precisely the same thing in this country. Now what happened is that in 1995, the government realized they had to look at it. So So they had a Supreme Court commission governed, ran by a man called Sir Ronald Wilson. And Sir Ronald Wilson was a Supreme Court judge and a well-known person and very respected and fine. So he was a good person to run, to set up this actual search to try and have a real look at it, because all the rumors were starting to come to the surface. Now, Sir Ronald Wilson listened to thousands of stories of children who had been taken away. People who remember the stories being taken away didn't always know where from, but they knew the story. They remember the crying. The truck would be leaving and the kids would be screaming, mother, father, they just take them away. And Sir Ronald Wilson, in that whole process, became a human being. So this report, instead of just being a government report, became a report with heart and soul and recommendations that were genuinely going to be valuable. People told the story, he believed them, and then he would tell those stories when to the rest of society. And when you listen to Sir Ronald Wilson, you just can't help but cry as he tells the stories. So what was simply a government commission turned out to be something very powerful. And so in 1996, the first anniversary of that report coming out, or 1997, we had what was called Sorry Day in Australia to remember. Because everybody, that report, more than anything else, made us feel a sense of shame about our past. Lots of other things. You can say, oh, there was a massacre here. Oh, that's all past. I had nothing to do with that. But by George, this happened until 1970. We all did have a part in it.
We count. Was in 67. 67 days.
Yeah. Yours was happening until 67. How many people knew about the stealing of children, Native American children here? Probably. Yeah. But this happened in Australia. And we basically were ignorant of it. We all believed these were orphanages. And now, suddenly, it happened. It was all revealed, and it was as clear as the day is long, it was obvious it was true. And so on. In 1997, we had Sorry Day, and these huge marches, great marches across Sydney Harbour Bridge. Every big city had a big march. I was heavily involved in the marches in Adelaide. And in those marches, we identified, we began to recognize we had to do more for reconciliation than simply follow the government policy. So grassroots movements of reconciliation began, which were far more significant in the end they're going to be than government policy, which says, well, we've got to be, you know, like, but our current government, Howard government, refuses to formally apologize and say sorry. Now, I will just tell you the little one little piece, is that, and that's connected with the place that's near where I am, called Colebrook Home, in 1997, 98. There was this big sculpture. We hired a very fine sculptor who was sympathetic, and he carved the faces of five people, all weeping. And above them is a kulam, and that's a dish that's used for collecting seeds or for carrying a baby. And the water flows over the faces, and it's called the Fountain of Tears. And that's a picture of one of them. And they're actual people who are in that home who are still alive. Now, we had our ceremony at that, in which we all recognized what had happened. We acknowledged it. Declared our shame, we made our apology. And one of the women from the stolen generation, a woman called Loacha O'Donoghue, a leading Australian Aboriginal woman, after we had made our apology, she stood up and she said, and this was not rehearsed, she stood up and she said, we, the stolen generation children of Colebrook, forgive you. We forgive you. I have never been the same since. I can no longer not identify with that. That was the gospel
in a nutshell, that moment. And this was my little book trying to capture that. Now, at the end of this book, if you're ever interested, there are 7 rites of healing. Rites of healing that are connected with 7 events, a massacre, and so on, the Maralinga disaster, and so on. But those 7 events, those 7 rites, are each connected with 7 words of the cross. And they have an interplay. Like, today you'll be with me in paradise. Today we're going on the march. Today we will be with me in paradise. Today we will end the lives of these troublemakers, and so on. So the interaction between the two words. That's this all sold out after the last talk, but you can get it if you want to have a look at it. Now, it's important then that we, things are beginning to happen at a grassroots level in terms of reconciliation, and that movement is important. And part of that movement is to say, we not only recognize what we've done, we recognize that you, Skokomish man, Skokomish elder, you are the custodian at this place. This is, you are the custodians of this place, even if by law you don't yet own, you still own the land. But you're the traditional owners, and we recognize you. Now, in order to make this work, we are working to get churches, schools, whatever, to formally recognize them. Just one thing is to recognize who you were, that you were. I'm chair of the council of a high school. And as chair of that council, I finally managed to get the council, with the erection of a new building, to put up a reconciliation sculpture by the same man that did this, which has 2 symbols. The dove, which is the Christian symbol of the school, and a glossy ibis, which is a symbol of the creative spirits of the indigenous people. And they sit side by side. And then the hard bit, the new sign of the school now reads, Emmanuel College, School of the Lutheran Church, located on Kaurna land, indigenous land. Now that's a testimony. It's not just in the curriculum, it's up front, that people can see we've made a statement, a start. Let me pause there. Comments, questions? Now I want to take you back into the culture. You can keep the tape running, it's all right. Let me draw a map of Australia. Best I can. That doesn't work at all. Not bad. Considering. Now, you know where all of the big cities are, and I'm not going to worry about that. If you are going to understand the culture of Australia, you need to know the traditional cultures, plural, I should say. There's a term which is some of you have come across, which is called songlines. Songlines is a term which refers to the fact that crisscrossing the country, all over the country, with millions and thousands of these things, are songlines. Song lines are several things. They are, first of all, the trail of a particular ancestor. And in some cases, the trail of that ancestor might go all the way for 2,000 miles. The trail of the ancestor, even though there may be 6 or 7 different peoples along that trail.
The same song can be traced. Now, the trail of the ancestor is one thing. The actual song story is the other. And that song story will have a dozen, hundred, umpteen episodes in it. As the ancestor takes that trail and does this and does this and does this and does this. And the people who are in this section will repeat the stories that belong to that. The people in this section will repeat another set of stories. The same ancestor, the same trail, the same song, the same melody, essentially, but different story. Because the ancestor, as he goes or she goes across the landscape, which is once flat at the beginning, makes a mountain, causes a river, leaves a well, a soak, a spring, and so on. Now all these stories are encoded, preserved in song and ritual. So it's not just a story. And most of the time when some of you go to Australia and buy a historic collection of Aboriginal myths or stories or legends, you've got a white person's summary of the thing. The original will not be a story in that form, but will be a ritual that is being performed in a very definite way. Now, this ancestor might be, for example, a wallaby man. And that ancestor is the wallaby ancestor. He's a creator being. He's a creator being who traveled that distance and is the source of all wallabies. And was himself. He can change from being a wallaby to a human being and back again. Now, all of these, all over the country, represent not only story and trail, but also what we would call boundaries for a particular tribal group. You know your territory. There may have been some battles here and there, but they were not. And the remarkable thing about Australian Aborigines is they're not a warlike people. The Maoris are much more powerful and warlike and different, a very different kind of people. But virtually across the board, you'll find a very, very few Aboriginal people were warrior people. They did not have weapons of mass destruction or even of little destruction, really. Basically, they fought, they killed kangaroos or whatever it was they needed for food. But the boundaries marked where the peoples were. And so there are hundreds of these, in fact, several hundred peoples across the country. Yes.
We have songs in our traditions where our songs are understood by other tribal nations, and those songs are a way of crossing through another boundary.
Yes.
And we use that as a way of going into somebody else's boundary, but going beyond his boundary, their boundary, and it's our way of going from one tribe to another tribe.
Yes.
Is by our song.
That's right. Thank you. Precisely the same thing. And sometimes you have tribal groups will come to a meeting place. And there'll be communal meeting places of different groups. And one of those common meeting places, traditional ones, at the most sacred center of Australia is a place called Uluru, which you might know as
Ayers
Rock. Ayers Rock is a sacred center in the heart of Australia. And at that sacred center, you've got all kinds of sacred things and a meeting place and a various variety of sacred sites associated with this particular rock. Now, I need to say a couple more things about traditional culture. There are sacred sites all along this line and all over the place. Sacred sites everywhere, just like you have sacred sites. And the efforts are now to try and not only know them, but to identify them and preserve them. There's another term I want you to know, which is the term dreaming. Sometimes you'll come across the word dream time, but that's a very inadequate translation because dream time suggests a time. Dreaming is the eternal power. Dreaming is the eternal power, creative power, that was there in the ancestor, and in the land, and in the whole ritual process. Now, the land is basically... all of us. Out of the land emerges an ancestor at the beginning of the dream. And the power of that ancestor, the power of the dreaming, is in the land as an eternal kind of power energy. That dreaming power comes up in the ancestor at the beginning of time. But when I perform a ritual about wallabies, then I activate that dreaming power in the ritual. It's a bit like the Eucharist. This is my body. It's there again. It's there. It's not once was my body. It is my body. The dreaming ancestor is not in the past. The ancestor is there. The power and the energy is activated through the ritual. And so the land is the source, and from that land, the energy is there. The dreaming is there. Now, one more thing about that dreaming. Everybody belongs to a dreaming. You could be a kangaroo dreaming, you could be a platypus dreaming, you could be a koala dreaming, you could be an ant dreaming, whatever. If you have a dreaming, then the same spirit, the same dreaming power is in you, is in the wallaby, is in the ritual, is in that sacred place. You have a common spirit with one of the creatures, which is a positive thing. We've cut ourselves off from that. I have a little place on Kangaroo Island where I like to go, which is south of Kangaroo Island down here. It's a little island, about as big as Israel. Now, this island, I have a little bird that's there called a blue wren. Have you heard of a blue wren? Anyway, a blue wren's got it's a beautiful, it's got its tail sticks straight up and it bounces. Anyway, every time I go to this place, I look for a blue wren. And if I have a dreaming, you would call it a totem. Dreaming and the totem are the same thing. We don't use the term totem because it's actually a Native American word. Well, it's used by anthropologists here. Yeah, anthropologists term for what you have. And sometimes...
They're storytellers.
Yeah.
Storytellers.
Yeah. We don't use the term totem anymore. We try to use the word dreaming because that's a more indigenous...
Right.
So I have this sense of kinship sometimes with certain creatures. The more I thought about it. Now, to appreciate the spiritual dimension of the land... Just one more story about that. My mentor in Aboriginal thinking, my major mentor, is a man called George Rosendale. He had a fifth grade education and became a Lutheran pastor. Never went to university or college or anything. He's an extraordinary man. But I listened to him. I just listened to him. And he tells two stories that you need to know. One is that back last century, the police came and raided his village, his little place where they were, and tried to slaughter everybody. It was an attempted massacre. But his grandmother preserved his mother by hiding her under the lily pads in a pond. Months later, they found the mother and the baby wandering around, and they took them to a mission. Now, when George was born, he said his mother went to this tree, which was a sacred tree for them. And after he was born, she took the afterbirth and buried it in the ground. Why? Because the birth happened here at a place called Hopewell. George had been taken from a place
mother had been taken from a place up here. But what the blood did, the spirit that's in the blood, made the connection. And he was always connected with his home place, to his sacred place, his dreaming place. So George is a turtle dream and a big sea turtle. He's connected with the turtles. So you have this sense that the land has got the capacity not only to hold the spiritual, but to transfer the spiritual, all kinds of aspects of the spiritual. And we've tended to, unfortunately, not see the spiritual dimension of land, but only, we said, well, I was in heaven or somewhere, you know. The land is...
We as spiritual leaders, it's, we call it seeing with spiritual eyes and having the insight.
Now, I'm going to pause there. There are lots of things that I could do a whole lecture on Aboriginal religions and culture. And remember, it varies and changes from time to time. And different ancestors are in different places from one part of the country to another. Questions before I move on? I now want to point you to this little book. This little book called Rainbow Spirit Theology is an effort on the part of George Rosendale and several other elders to say, inside of our Christian faith, we reaffirm our traditional culture. And this is how we do it. We redeem our traditional culture inside of our Christian faith. And what happened was that George said to me one day, Norm, I really wish I could write down what I believe, what I've discovered, and what's in my heart. But I can't. I said, well, maybe we can do it. So we got these elders together up in Queensland. We sat down for weeks and just wrote everything down. And I put it all together with them and then read back every word. It's their world. It's their belief. Now, the important kind of thing that happens here is, George says, there are different names. There's so much that's common between us and Christianity that you can't see unless you're one of us. And what we learned was extraordinary. The God, the figure that's key here, called the Rainbow Spirit. We're calling it Rainbow Spirit. And that's the great Rainbow Spirit. But that rainbow spirit was regularly portrayed as being under the ground as a great, huge snake. And this snake, when the monsoons would come, would swirl out, and at the end of the great rains, there would be the rainbow. But of course, when the missionaries heard about the snake, it didn't say rainbow. They intended to think of Genesis 3 instead of what they thought of. Instead of thinking of what Jesus said, just as the Son of Man, the snake was lifted up in the wilderness as a symbol of salvation, they used a symbol of damage. So these people are in the grips of Satan. And so he said we were never listened to. We were never listened to. But the rainbow spirit, the rainbow snake, is a powerful symbol, the great creator figure of that part of the world. And George, the actual name of that figure is Yirrumbala. That's their great creator snake. Now, we had a meeting with the Rainbow Spirit elders and Aboriginal people and several people from Samoa. Great big characters. Huge. These great big men were sitting there with the rest of us, and I felt like these great big guys. They're all Christian pastors, you know, some sort. About three quarters of the way through, one of these great big guys starts to shake all over. I've never said this, but our ancestor creator was a snake also, but we were damned if we ever mentioned it by the missionaries. Missionaries refused to listen. It was very powerful. And so we all began to realize just how much around the world creator being that George was saying is our creator being was never ever recognized as such. And what you've got, you read a few of the bits of this book, the kind of picture, this is one of the lines from you, I'll just read one little bit. The creator spirit is known to the Aboriginal Australians by many names. Yirrumbal, Biame, Rainbow Spirit, Payamu, Biral, Wanjina, and in Christian times, Father God. So that recognition that we know this God, not maybe just the way you know this Creator, but we know this Creator. And if you're going to understand us, you need to understand how we relate to the Creator. And you say to me, well, how can it be? And very often we have this difficulty of recognizing that not only was God there, but they knew that God was there. There's a wonderful passage in Acts where Paul is on Areopagus. Remember, he says, I will talk to you about the unknown God. I'll tell you who it is. As he goes along that chapter, he begins, says, right at the beginning, God created human beings and he divided up the world among all the peoples of the world. And every one of those peoples does what? Searches for God. And then he quotes some Greeks who were searching for God. And George Rosendale always says, there, see, there it is. God divided up the world and gave the peoples of the world, and he put us here. We are God's people in this place long before you guys got here.
Yeah. Our Native American people realize the real connection with Creator and the real strength of creation, that in many of our native languages there's no word for God. We know that that God is so strong and so much that we cannot have a comprehension of knowing who God is. That I was talking with a friend of mine last night for a long time, and in a couple of our churches, we're doing because we could not have a way of saying the word for God. We know the creation is so big and so astounding that we cannot have a word for God in our background.
Now, what time are we at?
About 16 to.
Till when?
Oh, yeah.
Till we stop or till 5 o'clock? Time is technically up. Yeah.
The Hebrews, too, they didn't really mention God's name. I mean,
who's that?
The Hebrew people, the Jewish, didn't they have something about that?
There wasn't. Not in the early period. In the later period, Jewish people did not want to say the actual name of God, which was revealed to Moses. But earlier in the piece, there were names for God they did use, like El and El Shaddai, and then Yahweh was clearly used as a name earlier. You could see it written in different places. But later, it became very holy after the exile period. But the earlier it was used, earlier. But there's a similarity, you're right. I must have been rambling because I was going to show you something else. I will give you, before I show you this, you can go if you want to. Answering the question for me is crucial. What was God doing in Australia before the Europeans came? One, God was creating a spiritual place for Australia. Two, God was creating peoples with cultures to be custodians of that place, to build that place, to prepare that place. And three, God was waiting for people who would come to recognize God there. The sad thing is, the third thing is only beginning to happen now. And then you ask the next question. If God was there creating a people and a culture which we've almost destroyed, we have to ask the question, what's God been doing since the Europeans came? God hasn't just been missionizing these people. God has been, if these were God's people, God has been with the Aboriginal people who for 200 plus years have done nothing but suffer. And if Christ is anywhere, Christ is always with those who
suffer.
Christ has been in Australia. Most of the time he's not where we've been looking. And I think it's important that from a Lutheran perspective, I recognize that. Not only that these were God's people, and I will continue to fight for the recognition of these as God's people, God's custodians, from whom we have a lot to learn, but also to recognize that in what we have done for the Aboriginal people, Christ has suffered. Now I'll take 5 minutes and just show you these. This is Genesis 1 in 5 minutes. In the beginning, the earth was dark and without form, but for Aboriginal people, God is where? Spirit is where?
In the earth.
In the earth. So there it is. These are the waters. Here's the earth, then here's God. He's the Creator Spirit. That's Genesis 1, verse 2. And then God says, let there be light. Now most of the time we think of light in terms of the sun, but this is lightning. The rainbow spirit represents the monsoons and everything else. The most logical understanding of light is let there be light, and there's lightning. Now these are very beautiful paintings, by the way. They're big paintings by one of the daughters of the Aboriginal elders, rainbow spirit elders. And then God said, well, I need a sky over the land. So here's the sky. God is still black because God still hasn't revealed the key part of where God is, namely the land. And so here is the sky over top. It's a very fast run through Genesis 1. Then God says, let the land appear. And here's the land beginning to appear, and God is now green and alive and appearing, and the land merges from the water. God still is in with and under the land. And God says, well, let's have some vegetation. Let the earth bring forth. And how a beautiful picture. Look at all the colors of the grass and the land and the trees. And God is in with and under it all. Good listeners. Let the dry land bring forth all of these green and seeds and everything else. Then, well, we need some sun and moon. So the sun and moon are created. The Creator Spirit is the force between them. Modulates. And then let the seas and the skies bring forth. And so you have birds and fish and all the rest brought forth out of the waters. And the rainbow snake, the rainbow spirit appears in the midst of it. Then let the dry land, and the Bible actually, this is totally indigenous. If you read Genesis 1, what happens on the sixth day? God says, let the land bring forth animals. God doesn't say let there be animals. exactly right. Animals. The animals all emerge from the land, just like the plants do. And that's, for the indigenous Aboriginal people, that's, of course that's right. That's the way it is. That was completely consistent with what they said and believed. Then God says, well, let's have some human beings. There's a wonderful picture. A mother with a baby. All different colors of creation. A mother with a baby. An old woman. Another woman. An old man. And a young woman. And last but not least, let's have a corroboree. Let's celebrate. Let's have the sixth day, which is the day of celebration, a ritual. Humans and the animals and God all participating in the ritual and the rainbow with all kinds of things over top. And so, what was God doing in Australia before the Europeans came? Preparing a culture that is so rich and people that are so impoverished, yet this spirit is still there. And I want to thank them for the privilege of being in that land and of knowing them. And thank you very much.